This bitter earth.
Hello, this is the General One podcast. This is Peter Fisher bringing you episode 7, which today will be about the special theory of relativity. No one
shares. If my life is like the dust.
So at this point, you're about a third of the way full through. So that means you've been doing this for about 6 weeks, which is 42 days. So if you add it up, you've been studying for 21 hours, if you have been sticking to the half hour a day. And that means in a normal work week, that would be equivalent to 1 week spending 4 hours a day, which you would never do. It's just you'd get bored after a couple of days. There's another reason I'm pushing this half-hour thing, and that has to do with just kind of general stress reduction. You've been in college for 4 years, and most of you haven't had a great deal of other responsibilities as far as family or work or things like that. But you're moving into a phase where you're going to have to learn how to balance things between different aspects of your work and family life and your own time. And an important skill to develop, especially when confronted with something onerous, like a general examination, is how to make a plan for something, figure out a schedule for accomplishing it, spend the time that you schedule, and then when you're not working on it, put it all in a little box and not worry about it. So that every time you think of the general exam, instead of thinking like, oh God, I need to study for that, I need to do more, You think to yourself, okay, general exam, I'm doing a half hour a day, I've got that under control, I don't have to think about it. The more things you can do that with in your life, the better off you're going to be. Because it's only going to get worse. You know, if you're lucky like me, and you know, you get to be a professor at a big place like MIT, you're never going to have just one general exam that you have to pass once in one term. You're going to have something like a general exam pretty much happening every month. And if you adopt the strategy that you're going to dither and then panic at the last minute, you're just not going to get very far. At the very least, you're going to lead kind of a miserable life. So what you need to do is be able to figure out what you need to do, work out when you're going to do it, and then spend that time working on it. Another important thing that I'm trying to communicate to you is the idea of good enough. Again, in my life, it's very important that I don't try to do everything perfectly. The things that I can get away with doing good enough, I do just good enough. And, you know, maybe I'm not always proud of it, but there are so many things going on that you really just can't do everything that you want. So remember, the object of the general exam is not to get a perfect score. The object is to pass. You want to pass comfortably. I'm not arguing that you should be at the bottom of the heap, but you don't want to obsess about it. The score just doesn't mean anything. All that means is you pass. So anyway, that's one reason I'm spending time doing this, is I really want you guys to develop the ability to put things away and not think about them when you're not worrying about them. There is a larger organizational scheme built around this philosophy. It's embodied in a book called Getting Things Done by David Allen. And if you're interested in organization schemes, this one's really pretty good. There's also a website called 43folders.com that talks a little bit about David Allen stuff and other things. It has some pretty good stuff on it. They also have a podcast. The guy whose name is Merlin. And 43folders, 43folders.com. So give that a look if you're interested in sort of avant-garde organizational strategies. One of the things David Allen says is that what the idea of organization is really to free your mind. He says your mind's really a bad boss. It forgets things. It doesn't pay attention. It kind of does what it wants. And what you really need is a system for keeping track of stuff so that your mind can do what it does best, which is kind of think big, global, squishy, creative thoughts. And you need to capture those thoughts and systematize them and figure out which ones to execute and which ones to just forget about. Anyway, that's one thing I think about and hope you guys learn how to do. The special theory of relativity is one of the most interesting things that you've been exposed to. You might learn something about the general theory. The special theory of relativity presents a lot of problems about space and time, and really comes from two postulates from Albert Einstein in 1905. One is that the law of physics is the same in all inertial coordinates. The other is that the speed of light is the maximum velocity obtainable in any coordinate system and is the same in all coordinate system. Sort of the cornerstone of general relativity are the Lorentz transformations of space and time, and they are x equals gamma x prime plus beta gamma t prime, and t equals gamma t prime plus beta gamma times x. I've cast those all in dimensionless units, so you can put in the velocity of light factors where appropriate. Now, of course, you'll remember the Lorentz transformation. What you won't remember is the sign. And remember that the sign depends on whether the lab coordinate system is moving in the positive or negative direction with respect to the transformed coordinate system. So one thing that you should do in preparation for General 1 is get used to very quickly drawing the two coordinate systems on the same sheet of paper. So one is going to be Cartesian, meaning the coordinate axes are going to be orthogonal. The other will have the coordinate axes either acute or obtuse. And trace out the origin of the x-coordinate in order to determine the sign in the Lorentz transformation. Because it could either be x equals gamma x prime plus beta gamma t prime, or minus beta gamma t prime, and it depends totally on context, which is correct. In special relativity, there's a very large class of, quote, paradoxical, unquote, problems. These are things usually where you assume simultaneity means something and it really doesn't. So, for example, there's the barn and pole problem, where there is a barn of length proper length L, and a pole of proper length L, and a runner carries the pole held horizontally and runs through the barn. So the barn has a front door and a back door, and the pole goes in the back door and out the front. So the paradox is in the lab frame where the barn is at rest, the runner runs through, the runner appears to be Lorentz contracted, so the pole has a length of L over gamma, where gamma is 1 over 1 minus beta squared, and beta squared is velocity divided by the speed of light. So the pole is Lorentz contracted by a factor of gamma, goes into a barn of length L, and appears that there's a time when the pole is completely contained within the barn. On the other hand, from the runner's point of view, the runner is running along carrying the pole of length L, sees the barn Lorentz contracted to a length L over gamma, and so consequently he would say, or he would observe, that the pole never fits within the barn. What's going on? Well, the answer to this really lies in the fact that the two events of the front of the barn going out the front door and the front of the pole going out the front door and the back of the pole going in the back door are not simultaneous. So when you say fit within the barn, what are you saying? Are you saying that the pole is at some simultaneous time fit completely in the barn? What does it really mean? Well, the only real answer to this is to say that the original problem is not very clearly stated. And so the way to really resolve this is that to make specific what fit inside the barn means. So then the usual modification of the problem is to say, okay, well, there's a bomb that's located halfway through the barn and is at rest with respect to the barn, and it's connected by two wires to sensors at the front and the back. And if the pole is ever at the front and the back, when the pole front passes the front sensor or back passes the back sensor, it creates an electrical signal that travels with the velocity of light to the bomb. And the question then is, does the bomb go off or not? And then you make the same argument about the runner rest frame and the barn rest frame. The bottom line of this is that, well, first of all, in general, the bomb does go off. But the way to solve the problem is to draw a very, very careful diagram on a Minkowski diagram. So, for example, choose the barn as the rest frame. And so the world lines of the front and the back of the barn go along lines of constant x, for example, x equals 0 and x equals L, and then draw the world lines of the pole, the front and the back of the pole, and see where they intersect the front and the back of the barn, respectively, and then draw the electrical signals propagating in the plus and minus x direction with the velocity of light, and see if they arrive simultaneously at the bomb location. So any of these paradoxical questions, the first thing you should do is think about drawing a Minkowski diagram and correctly labeling the events. The other thing you should do is look at the statement of the problem and make sure that there are no accelerations imposed on any of the frames. Remember, all the Lorentz transformation can do is connect two inertial frames moving with respect to one another at constant velocity. If there's any acceleration involved, then you cannot use the Lorentz Lorentz transformation. You can, if you integrate over small steps of constant relative velocity, but that's very, very tricky and outside the scope of this. Rindler, for example, has an example of how to do this. So the key to all of these paradoxes are, number one, identifying cases where one of the frames is accelerating, and usually the question is cast in such a way that you can get around that, and drawing careful Minkowski diagrams. Now, another place relativity comes up a lot are in energy momentum problems. Here you have a particle object that's in collision with another object, perhaps at rest. And what you have to do is transform into the center of mass frame, do something, and then transform out of the center of mass frame. The key to these problems is, number one, again, make sure you get the sign in the Lorentz relation correctly. And the relevant Lorentz relation is E equals gamma E prime plus beta gamma P prime, and P equals gamma P prime plus beta gamma E prime, and you have to get the sign in those right, which you can do in the manner I described before. Energy and momentum relations do prove very useful, but remember you're dealing with four vectors now, and one of the properties of the four vector of a particle is that the magnitude of the four vector squared is equal to the mass of the particle squared. So remember the Einstein relation, m squared equals e squared minus p squared. I'll leave you to put in the C's in the correct place. This can make a wide class of problems very easy to do. For example, here's a classic problem of Compton scattering. There's free electron at rest. A photon of energy E hits the electron, scatters at an angle theta. The electron scatters at an angle phi. Find the energy of the electron as a function of scattering angle phi. Initially, this looks like a very hard problem to do, if you write out the energy and momentum components and apply them, apply the conservation laws. Here's a little trick, and you should try this out just to see how it works. Let P be the four vector of the electron, and K be the four vector of the photon before the collision. And P prime and K prime are the four vectors after the collision. Then you can write energy and momentum conservation as P plus K equals P prime plus P plus K equals P prime plus K prime. Now, make use of the fact that 4 vector squared gives a constant, and rewrite the expression as P minus P prime equals K prime minus K. Square both sides, remembering that there are 4 vectors, so one side will be P prime squared minus 2 K dot P, where the dot products are four-dimensional dot products, plus P prime squared, and similarly for K. You should then notice that K prime and K are both squared, are both equal to zero, because the rest mass of the photon is zero, and P prime and P squared are ME squared. Then you can just write down the answer to the relationship between the energy and angular momentum of the electron after the scattering. You should practice that. It's a very, very easy thing to do. Here's another practice problem that's based on the Grison, Zaltzepin, Kuzemann, GZK cutoff. The physics behind this is the following. The three gentlemen I just mentioned had the theory that you would never observe a cosmic ray proton above a certain energy, because as the cosmic ray proton at high energy propagates through the interstellar medium, it can hit one of the microwave photons that have a temperature of 3 degrees. The microwave photon turns the proton into a delta resonance, which has a mass of about 1130. The delta resonance is kind of an excited state of a proton and decays to a pion plus a proton. So what the delta resonance has the effect of doing is taking away a little bit of, well, what this process has the effect of doing is taking away a pion mass of energy from a very energetic proton. So calculate the kinematics, take the photon propagating in the plus Z direction with some energy that corresponds to 3 degrees Kelvin, and the proton propagating in the minus Z direction with some very large energy. Calculate the energy that the proton needs to turn into a delta by transforming into the rest frame. Then have the delta decay to a pion plus a proton. Calculate the momentum of each and assume the proton makes an angle theta with respect to the direction of the initial proton. Now boost back into the laboratory system and calculate the maximum energy of the final state proton, and hence give an approximation for the proton energy of the cutoff. This is a very good problem and encompasses a wide class of scattering problems. Going back to the other business of paradoxes, another problem that you can work on that has a paradoxical nature to it is consider a guy riding a skateboard of length L that's relativistic. And he rides over an open manhole of radius L. Does the skateboard fall into the manhole or not? You'll have to use the argument about the two electrical contacts and worry about the propagation of electrical signal, as I mentioned before, in order to make the problem specific enough to really answer the question. Generally, relativity problems are fairly straightforward. Remember how to handle the relativistic transformations of the electric and magnetic field. You can either simply memorize the Lorentz transformations of E and B, or you can make use of the fact that what you can do is transform physical systems to figure out. For example, consider the Lorentz transformation of an electric field. So what you want to do is say that there's a capacitor where there are two plates of side L and area L squared. The plates are electrically charged, so they make an electric field. And now consider a frame moving with respect to this large, this idealized capacitor with a velocity V. Take into account the Lorentz contraction of the two plates and use that to calculate the transformed electric field. You can also do this for the perpendicular case and for the magnetic field, in which case you Lorentz transform the currents. Have a look at the Lorentz transformations and think about how you can do this physically in case you have trouble remembering them. Another interesting wide class of electricity and magnetism and relativity problems has to do with an electron circling in a constant magnetic field. So you all know that an electron given some velocity in V will make a cyclotron orbit in a magnetic field, and the orbit frequency will depend on the electric charge, the magnetic field, and the mass. And be sure that you can work out that orbit rotation very quickly. Now, in the Newtonian case, the frequency does not contain a gamma factor, but in the relativistic case, the Lorentz frequency does. And be sure you can work through both cases. The only difference is, well, what you always want to do is work in terms of momenta rather than velocities. And as long as you're using F equals P dt, or F equals P dot, relativistically you're okay. But it does take a bit of time to separate the two coordinates. Now, a classic problem is to ask the student to consider an electron orbiting in a magnetic field and then apply a transverse electric field and ask what happens if an electric field of magnitude equal to the magnetic field is applied. Remember, this was a CGS problem where the electric and magnetic field have the same magnitude, have the same units. So you should be able to work out what happens to this orbiting particle in a transverse electric and magnetic field. In general, relativity problems tend to be straightforward if you know the basic things about relativity. And the thing I can't really emphasize enough in cases of coordinate transformations and world lines is the importance of drawing a Minkowski diagram. As far as the kinetics go, the kinetics is straightforward kinetics as long as you keep into account that you have to conserve energy and momentum. And the best way to do this is by working in four vectors. So practice working things in four vectors as much as possible. Another big topic has to do with Doppler shifts. Know how to work out both the relativistic and non-relativistic Doppler shift. The non-relativistic Doppler shift just has terms that go like 1 over beta, or 1 plus, or 1 over 1 minus beta, or 1 over 1 plus beta, whereas the relativistic Doppler shift has a square root of 1 minus beta over 1 plus beta. Be sure you can work that out quickly. It's relatively simple to do. The difference between the relativistic and non-relativistic Doppler shift is just the addition of time dilation, which gives a factor of 1 over gamma. So, and that's what leads to the 1 minus beta over 1 plus beta behavior that I mentioned. So here's a problem. Suppose there's a flashlight aimed at the origin of the coordinate system, and in the lab frame it makes an angle theta. You come along in a high-speed craft going at some velocity v and observe the spotlight just as you cross the origin of coordinates. What angle do you observe the light at as a function of angle in the lab coordinate system? If you remember when in Star Wars, when they made the jump to hyperspace, they actually tried to get right this forward peeking of the stars that you would observe at large accelerations. As you certainly know, relativity is built right into the electromagnetic theory, and the electric field is, in some senses, really just a Lorentz transformation of the magnetic field, and vice versa. One very important argument to understand and to be able to reproduce is an argument given for the magnetic field in Purcell, and I think it's in the fifth chapter. If somebody wants to remind me, I'll dig out exactly where it is. Basically, what Purcell does is he says, look, we have the Coulomb force law, but we don't know whether or not the Coulomb force law applies to something that's moving. So here's an electrical wire carrying a current, and here's a particle moving parallel to the wire at velocity v. So we don't know how to apply the Lorentz force law to the current. The wire is electrically neutral, but carrying a non-zero current. So what we'll do is we'll transform into a frame where the electrical particle is at rest and the wire is moving. So what he then shows is that by calculating the density change because of the Lorentz contraction of the ions in the wire, which were at rest in the lab frame and are now moving in with velocity minus v, that contributes one electric field. The current, which suffers both a Lorentz contraction and a change in velocity because of the way you add velocity is relativistic, suffers a different Lorentz contraction. So in a frame in which the particle is at rest, the wire appears to have an electrical charge. And you can calculate the force on the particle. And then you can use the Lorentz transformations to go back into the laboratory system and transform the force. You might be wondering how to transform the force. Remember that the force is dp dt, and dp and dt both transform as Lorentz vectors, so it's a matter of writing dp dt as dp prime plus beta gamma dE prime, etc., and carrying out the differential. It's a rather simple thing to do, and you should practice doing it. Remember how to do the simple basic things with the Lorentz transformation and Minkowski diagrams. That will serve you well, both in solidifying your knowledge of special relativity and in approaching the exam. There are a lot of more complicated things that really require memorization, which probably aren't so valuable. So a few interesting things this week. One of them was in Science. I think it's the most recent issue I think it's still the one with the Golden Gate Bridge on it. There's a picture of M31, Andromeda galaxy. And apparently what happened is some guys have done a good X-ray image, a high-resolution image of X-ray in the X-rays, I think with SWIFT. And what they see are two holes in Andromeda, one in the center near the core of the galaxy, and the other on the outermost spiral arm. And they've done some numerical simulations, and Andromeda has a little satellite galaxy called M32. And what happened was M32 is bound to Andromeda, and in an elliptical orbit perpendicular to the plane of Andromeda. And this orbit goes right through the center up above Andromeda, and then M32 turns around and plunges back through Andromeda on about the outer spiral arm.
And these two holes are tidal disruptions from the passage of M32. And the two holes are consistent with numerical simulations these guys have done. And there's a really pretty cool picture where an actual X-ray image, I believe, where you can really see Andromeda come in and M32 come in and go out, leaving two holes. I thought that was really pretty cool. The other interesting thing I learned was we had a dark energy, dark matter lunch. This is a group of us that get together every other week to talk about dark energy and dark matter. I go because I'm a Kavli scholar and I'm interested in dark matter. Ed Birchinger was replaying a talk that he gave at NRAO about dark energy. And the idea is this, that dark energy could be a modification of the Einstein's equations. It could be something that, a substance, let's say, or it could be that we don't understand Einstein's equations of general relativity, particularly the equation that relates the stress energy tensor with the Riemann tensor, or the, I guess it's the Ricci tensor. Anyway, two of these were pretty obvious. We may not understand Einstein's equations in the sense that we have to add a cosmological constant or something more complicated. That's okay. I can't say I understand that, but I know roughly what it means. It could be that there is some other substance, some field quintessence or something. I can understand that too, or at least I know what that means. The third thing was perhaps we're not interpreting Einstein's equations properly, and I asked what that meant, and I actually learned something that I just had never thought about. And that's, if you boil it down for the universe and the Friedman-Walker or the Robertson-Walker metric and assume the universe is isotropic, etc., etc., you get something that relates the acceleration parameter A and the stuff in the universe, which for an isotropic homogeneous universe is rho, the density, plus 3p. So that's the stuff, and then that's times g, and there's some pi's and an 8 somewhere, I think. What Ed pointed out is that equation is correct for a static gas in three dimensions, which is, of course, true. But there could also be a lot of energy that's tied up in turbulence, gases swirling around, black holes, the total energy near the surface of a black hole. That should enter into there as well. And he and Paul Schechter call these nonlinear effects because obviously they're very hard to calculate. We don't even know about them. And it could be that this is just enough to make up for the acceleration constant, which we see measuring supernova and the microwave background. I was really struck by this because, my background in history is in particle physics. I've always been kind of interested in astrophysics. But one tends to think, because there's so much hype surrounding dark energy and dark matter, that there's a new standard model of cosmology, and that just isn't true. The standard model of particle physics is well established and has been tested in hundreds and hundreds of experiments with high precision in the third or fourth decimal point. This new picture of cosmology is just the barest hint. It's based on a few measurements, and there are a lot of assumptions, and one of them is that the stuff in the universe, the dark matter and the baryons, is characterized by rho plus 3p. And that right there is a huge assumption. So for those of you who are kind of outside the field, be aware that this is really, really confusing. And particularly if you're in particle physics, don't think you're going to make the jump into this, like jumping into a warm swimming pool. It's more like a cold rushing stream. As always, if there's something you'd like to send, a question or comment or something you'd like me to cover, please email me at fisherp.mit.edu. Even if you're not from MIT, please feel free. As always, I'd like to thank Sheila Holzer and her husband John Marston for technical help, and Anna Newman and Homer Reed at REFS, and Sean Thompson, Laboratory for Nuclear Science. And I'll talk to you next week. And until then, have a good week here in Cambridge or wherever you are. And I'm getting old. Keep me searching for a heart of gold. And I'm getting old. Hollywood, I've been to Redwood, I crossed the ocean.